around 1940, they were reorganizing. There had been some strikes earlier on of which I was not involved, because I was a coal miner before that. Mm-hmm. And these strikes were invariably not successful. And then they commenced to reorganizing under the guidance of Nigel Morgan, Harold Prichette, who at that time was the international president, and Hjalmar Bergen, George Grafton, who was dead, and several others. Anyway, I was describing the IWA. This was known as Local 180 of the IWA. It's known as the Local 180 IWA, and it was divided in sublocals. We had a sublocal here, Chimenez, Yubo, Lake Cowichan, Honeymoon Bay, Gordon River Camp, and all the various camps, Bear Creek Camp, Hess Creek, Port Renfrew. They all had their sublocals, you see,
right,
at which they conducted their own little business in their own localities, taking care of grievances and so on. The president, secretary, and committees, etc. And then the head office, or the local 180 office of the local, was in Duncan. And monthly they would hold meetings in Duncan of Local 180, at which time delegates would come from all these other areas and sublocals and meet and discuss the various problems. The final decisions was always with the local.
Right.
But they conducted their own little local affairs in each locality, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so therefore, the auxiliary followed the same pattern. Mm-hmm. There was the Local 180 auxiliary, and then each little town and village and camp, out in the camps, they all had their little auxiliaries, big or small, whatever, you know. Women in those days, there were a lot of very interested women and supporting their husband too, but there was also many that weren't. It's not every woman that supports her husband on a picket line, you know. You probably know that from reading whatever you've read and so on. And not always did it work out well, you know. They didn't like the old man not bringing in the paycheck. A lot of them, you see. But then again, many others. So then, one of the prime objects of these auxiliaries would be to educate the other women as to what was required and what benefits could be had by being organized in a union in order to get contracts and so on, which was unheard of then in the early 40s. It wasn't until 46 that we really got a postwise contract, a master contract. See? So that was the main object of these women, that you could get them out as talk to other women and so on. That was one thing. The other thing was the social end of it. They would organize, at that time, maybe wish drives, dances, or various things in order to raise a little money to support themselves and so on, and to help wherever they could. See, so that was done. They supported in that manner socially as well.
Was that used to raise money for the union as well as the auxiliaries?
No, not so much. No, it would be for to support their own, shall we say, enterprises in support of the union. I'm searching for a word here. For instance, they'd need funds to work with, mm-hmm, in order to support it. They'd have to send delegates, send people to Duncan, send people here and there. So they needed their own money, and they didn't have to depend on union funds. Mm-hmm. So they raised their own money for their own activities, which were in support of the union.
Right.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Just to go back a little bit, when you were in the Mine Workers Union, was there also an auxiliary to that?
Not when I was in it.
The Mine Workers Women's Organization?
There was later on in the UMW of A, the United Mine Workers of America. But perhaps
you
I should...
You weren't involved in that at all?
No, I wasn't. Perhaps I could go back if you want to know about it. And this was in the early 30s, commonly known as the Hungry 30s. And I might say, as far as mine workers was concerned, coal miners, the Depression actually started in the early 20s, when we started to feel the pinch or the lack of trade in coal. coal mines, I guess. It doesn't matter. I guess you can straighten this out later.
Sure.
And they started to organize the mine workers under the Mine Workers Union of Canada. Mm-hmm. That was the name of it. The last time that there'd been any organization, to my knowledge, was in the big miner strike of 1912, 13, 14, when the union was broken. The strike was broken, I should say, and the union faded out of existence and did not come in existence again. And that was the United Mine Workers of America. And then there was nothing. And all the period I worked in mines, there was nothing. Until about 1933, 34 maybe, they started to organize on the Mine Workers Union of Canada underground. Because if you were caught even saying union, you would be fired, let alone anything else.
So it was clandestine organization.
So then, there was just the men being organized. Just a moment before you write, the men was being organized in a cell system. Do you know what that is?
What did
Six
you just
or seven say? Men would be would get together. I would know the person I could trust. I would ask him. And we'd form a cell, and there would be a leader of that cell. And there was different cells, although never more than a dozen or 11 or a dozen men. Because if one of you got fired for union activity, you could pinpoint it to those few in your group who squealed to the boss. You see, that was the idea of it. And then, of course, there was a secretary and so on. And you never knew who was in the other groups. The group leaders come together and made their plans or decisions and so on. Then took them to their own group, we'll call them groups, took them to their own groups, reported back, got suggestions, had discussion, and then again back they would go with a meeting of the leaders of each group, and they would form a decision and so on, which was then carried on. Then this was not very successful because it was too slow. Men would get fed up. We paid 50 cents a month dues. Men would get fed up paying their dues. Nothing was happening. You know, you daren't come out in the open. You daren't do anything but just try and get as many men into the union. Well, after a while, you found that there's some of them, especially the weak spined, would be dropping off. You'd maybe get a few new ones. But the amount of men that you could really trust and ask to join were not that great. So it wasn't too successful. Then the United Mine Workers of America come in, and of course they come right out in the open and brought in their organizers, you see, and then and began organizing. And they took over this work, and it wasn't long before there was a contract with the mining companies of the area. Now, I do know that of course, naturally, the women knew. My wife over there, she knew all about it. I was a group leader, as a matter of fact. In fact, I was secretary for ladies' club. And in Cumberland, I think is about where it got started. There's big mines there then. And I do think that there was some women secretly also active, you know, amongst the wives and so on, quietly doing their little thing, educating the women to the benefits of trade unionism and what it could do for them in the future and their families. Hey, I'm getting back into shape. So this did transpire then, but it never got off the ground until the United Mine Workers came in. And at that time, there was a mine where I work was shut down. As I mentioned before, that the early 20s actually was the beginning of the depression for coal miners. Then by this time, there was not too many mines working anymore. They were closing down and so on, lack of trade. People were going to wood, oil, electricity, hydroelectric. And even all your steamships and railroad engines and so on were all oil, where they used to burn coal, see? So that was all, even the heating of the homes was fading out. So it just gradually faded away. So I never got a job again in a coal mine. And I don't think I would have got one anyhow, because I was one of a group. The boss always had a way of being suspicious, you know, who might be who, you know. They could tell by your attitude and all sorts of things, you know. And this mine I worked at closed down, and they opened another one. And the men in Ladysmith were afraid that they wouldn't get placed in this mine, but the nine mine workers would. So we held a meeting right up here, a mine workers. Not union, you just somehow or other you get it out that the mine workers are meeting tonight, and they get into the hall there. And I was on a committee that went to the management and asked if we couldn't have our fair share of workers from Ladysmith employed, it was called the Reserve Mine, the Indian Reserve at the Nine River. That's why it was called Reserve. And of course, we were promised a fair share and so on. But at the same time, this must be some of the ringleaders in here, you see. So I never did ask for another job, and I never was offered one either. I was young and husky then. And I went to work for the woodwork in the woodworking industry.
Can I just ask one question? Were there any women who organized for the mine workers? I remember hearing about women like Mother Jones.
Oh, that's way back.
That was way back.
Oh, yeah, that's Mother Jones.
That was the earliest.
I only have heard of her, no more than you have. And that's way back in the early history of the Mine Workers Union. Mm-hmm. That would be back in the 1910, 11, 12 era, when the organizer finally came on strike.
Was she ever up around here?
I'm not just sure about that. No, I can't say. And I wouldn't say without knowing for sure. Okay.
So we're at you becoming a woodworker, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, of course, there were, again, after being defeated in several strikes, you might say, not all, but there was no master agreement or anything of that sort. Started to reorganize. And then I became involved in that reorganization, I would say, in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, we too were more or less, had to be rather cute about it, you know. You couldn't just come out in the open and so on. Although the authorities pretty well knew who was who and so on. So then we commenced organizing, building unions, and building, and we did just that. And here and there, there was some little agreements signed with certain small companies that might be more interested in getting good loggers and good production than they were whether they held a union on or not. If they could find a good hooker or a good high rigger, they didn't give a damn whether he was a union organizer or not. They'd hire him. So as a result, I'm thinking of the old Lake Logan as one of these examples. And there was another place up Courtney Way too, where the same thing happened. But anyhow, I got involved as one of the men and ladies from here, along with a lot of others. And then the women's, I can remember organizing a women's auxiliary. We called a meeting. They called a meeting of interested women. And here's the way that happens. The men who were leaders in the organization, of course, they got their wives to come to this meeting, you know, and we contacted all these women. And so we formed, then you had a nucleus of women who formed the, organized the auxiliary. And that's the way it went.
Okay. Were these women also active in the CCF or other political organizations?
Not necessarily so, no. I wouldn't say so.
Right.
No, I can't think of any of them who were. I can't think of any who were really active in the CCF. I can think of a few that were in the CCF, like Barbara Wallace, the president of MLA. Her people weren't involved in the woodworking union, and Barbara Wallace, Mrs. Simpson, who was dead, Ann Beer, who was still alive, who was up in the Thielen Street. She wasn't involved in the building of auxiliaries, but she was in the CCF. And naturally, they were interested in promoting the unions too, because what is it? It's partial the same thing, almost anyway. One's a political front, and one's an economic front.
Okay, and what kind of... strike and a bit of what you told me off tape about that.
Role would probably be as an auxiliary to the union, helping in the way that women can help, and social functions, and providing food or coffee or and so on of anything that's going on. But probably one of the prime functions would be trying to educate and other women whose husbands were union members or weren't union members, it didn't matter which, into trade union thinking and showing them the benefits of the trade union movement to the working people, to themselves, and to their children and so on their, whereby they could acquire better living conditions, better wages, working conditions, working out, and safety. I almost forgot that. In those days, safety was a big factor in the organized ethnic trade union movement. Because here's something for the books. They'll deny this right and left, but during the war, the casualty rates on the BC coast logging industry was higher than it was at the front in the war. Now that's hard to take, but it was. One out of every three men could expect to be on compensation in his life. One out of every three would be injured and come under compensation, either seriously, otherwise, or fatally. See? So the thing was, one of the things was in the development of our union was to educate women to the unsafe conditions that their husbands were working under. And this is some way they could help, and so on, you know. In other words, get them to support their husband. If you want, just on an individual business, yes, Joe, you're doing the right thing, join the union, and this sort of thing, instead of raising hell with him for joining the union, and also what it would cost them in dues and so on, you see, and assessments. So this was part of the role of the Women's Auxiliary.
Did women struggle around safety conditions at all? Were there any specific things that women did?
No, not specific. But, I mean, this was just an overall picture, you know. That was one of the things that we based our organization on, the working conditions, hours of work, and safety, you see. So in this way, we can get women to look at it in that manner, you know. Then it would help us, because you'd be surprised how many women are against their husband becoming involved at that time, in trade union, because all they could see was a picket line and strike and nothing to eat for the kids, or debts, which would take them a long period to pay off if there was a strike and so on. Another thing was, their function would be to also to raising money in various ways to help support, because it would come a time we would, if we anticipated a strike, we'd be assessed for a strike fund. They could also assist here with money raising and so on. And that was done during the strike, as well as all the other support that I mentioned before, socially, and also, as I described before, how the local was functioned with the headquarters in Duncan during the six-week strike. It was a six-week strike when the women had a sort of a, what would you call it, a lunch kitchen, if you like, call it that, where they provide a meager meal. I mean, no, I shouldn't say meager, but a plain meal, that's the better word, a plain meal for the men who were there on the central committee, because we did have to have a central committee to take care of the strike, and also to form plans and so on, you know, as to what we should do, policy and program. What should we do? Should we allow this or do this or do that or do the other thing? So these men daily met. I was one of them in Duncan. And then we'd go over there and get a meal at a very reasonable place. We could afford to pay for it, fine, 35 cents, two bits, whatever. But we'd always get, you know, potatoes and a little bit of meat and vegetables and so on. So a plain meal.
Did women picket at all during that strike?
No, it wasn't necessary. No, I don't think so. It wasn't necessary. There was plenty of men, and it didn't get to the point of desperation which some strikes get, where you'll see women out on the picket line on behalf of their husband. You'll see that, won't you?
Has that happened in this area during strikes?
Not to my knowledge. Not in my time, no. But we had the picket lines all well organized, both on the sea and on land. We had, because there was booms down there, and tugboats would come in maybe from the States or Seattle to take logs away, and we had men organized with boats to go out there and they picketed the logs, they stayed on there. But especially if they spotted a tugboat coming in the harbor, then they would be down on the boom and place picket signs all around. So that part was organized. Then on land, the entrances to the workplace and so on was picketed by shift all day, so many hours. And there would always be picket captains who were in charge of so many pickets and so on.